The American job market is strong, with employers adding more than 250,000 jobs last month.
President Biden hailed the news, but those high numbers may not be great for inflation. I'm Sarah McCammon.
I'm Aisha Roscoe, and this is Up First from NPR News.
The Peach State is gearing up for its Tuesday runoff between Democrat Raphael Warnock and Republican Herschel Walker.
We'll tell you how they're rallying their bases, hoping they can get voters back to the polls, with Warnock going after some Republican voters who might be nervous about his opponent's controversial record.
And a Frenchwoman made history on Thursday as the first female to referee a men's World Cup match.
So stay with us. We've got the news you need to start your weekend.
The U.S. job market is on a roll.
On Friday, we learned that employers added another 263,000 jobs last month, far more than forecasters were expecting.
The jobs report capped a week of mostly positive economic news, which President Biden praised.
As we go into the holiday season, here's what this all means. The Americans are working, the economy is growing, wages are rising faster than inflation.
NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now to tell us what all of this means. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Aisha.
So unemployment is very low, just 3.7% in November. It would seem like it's a good time for people who are looking for work, I think, right?
It is. Yeah, opportunities are plentiful. There are more job openings right now than there are people looking for work. And as a result, employers are having to bid up wages at a rapid rate. Now, the president is cherry-picking a bit when he says wages are outpacing inflation. There have been some months when that's been true, but over the last year, average wages have not kept up with inflation. Wages in November were up 5.1% from a year ago. We know that prices have been climbing faster than that. But there's no question wages are rising at a rapid rate. And while that's good for workers, Julia Pollack, who's chief economist at the job search website ZipRecruiter, says it could add even more fuel to the fires of inflation.
Wage growth does seem to be the main sort of contributing factor now to inflation. Initially, it was energy prices and supply chain issues and goods prices. But core services inflation is now very much the driving issue. And that is very much tied to wages.
Inflation watchdogs at the Federal Reserve are concerned about that. Even though we've started to see a drop in some prices, like gasoline and used cars, there's a worry that services could get more expensive as a result of those rising wages.
So that's why the Fed's been raising interest rates.
That's right. The Fed's been raising rates at the fastest pace in decades, from close to zero back in March to just under 4% today. That's making it more expensive to get a car loan or a home mortgage or just to carry a balance on your credit card. Now, this is designed to slow down the economy and the job market, but it's taking time. And outside of a few very sensitive sectors, we're not seeing much of a slowdown yet.
But, you know, as it turns out, you know, we got news this week that the economy grew faster in the late summer and early fall than was initially reported. So that sounds like a good thing.
When the third quarter GDP report came out about a month ago, the Commerce Department said the economy had grown at an annual pace of 2.6%. But revisions this past week showed the economy actually grew a little bit faster than that, 2.9%. Now, some of that growth is exaggerated by things like trade that have already started to turn around. But we have seen real improvement in business investment and consumer spending.
We just saw an avalanche of spending after Thanksgiving and the start of holiday shopping. A lot of that probably came from me personally because I know I was just spending money. But like, is that like a good sign? Like, you know, is the economy doing well with all of this retail spending?
The American consumer is very much alive and well, and that's important because consumer spending is the biggest driver of the overall economy. It's not clear, though, how long that can be maintained. Another report this week showed consumer spending in October rose faster than income did. Now, how does that happen? It means people are dipping into savings or putting it on the credit card. Early in the pandemic, when people couldn't spend money and the government was sending out relief payments, savings rates soared. But now that cash cushion is being whittled away. The savings rate in October was the lowest in 17 years. And at the same time, credit card debt is on the rise. So that cannot continue indefinitely.
Yeah, that doesn't sound very good. That's NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you so much, Scott.
You're welcome.
It's December, and yet the 2022 midterms are still happening, in Georgia at least.
Voting ends on Tuesday in the runoff election between Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock and Republican challenger Herschel Walker.
WABE's Sam Greenglass is following a couple of key voter groups and joins us now to explain how they could shape the results. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
So campaigns had just 4 weeks to get their base supporters back to the polls again for this runoff. How is each campaign approaching that?
Well, let's start with Walker. He has been rallying voters in some deep red counties, and his stump speech remains pretty focused on those conservative voters. He leans into culture war issues more than he talks about the economy.
We may need to get to leaders in Washington and say, if you don't like the rules of the United States of America, you can leave. We're not going to keep you here. That's what we need right now.
Warnock needs to juice turnout among reliable Democratic voters. The turnout rate for Black and Hispanic voters was actually down in November compared with 2018. Warnock talks about student debt relief and his vote to confirm Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, but he's also making this explicit play for independent voters and even Republicans who have reservations about Walker, given allegations of domestic violence and his many false claims.
This is not about right and left. This is about the difference between right and wrong.
So why is Senator Warnock pushing so hard for Republican-leaning voters? Like, is that realistic?
Well, you have probably heard the term split-ticket voters pop up specifically around this election. These are people who voted Republican for governor in November, but Democratic for Senate. And while that might seem like kind of a unicorn voter, they do exist, especially in the suburbs. And Walker did get about 200,000 fewer votes than Republican Governor Brian Kemp did in November. One of those voters who I have followed up with over the course of this campaign is Republican Cameron Llewellyn, and he told me recently he is going back to vote for Warnock again. He just cannot look past Walker's controversies.
I care about my taxes. I care about my kids, right? I care about inflation. So if you can speak intelligently about those things, you can earn my vote for that. But you're not going to earn my vote if essentially you try to portray yourself as something that you're not.
The question is whether others like Llewellyn come back or they stay home now that the Senate is the only race on the ballot. Plus, there are people who voted Libertarian or left the Senate race blank. What will they do? We don't know.
So are there any other groups you're watching heading into Tuesday?
I am keeping my eyes on 18 to 29-year-olds in Georgia. This is a group that broke heavily for Democrats. But their share of the electorate actually dropped in November over the last midterm, and the older age brackets vote at way higher rates than they do. But for the runoff, the Warnock campaign and voter outreach groups have amped up their canvassing on campuses specifically. I talked to Jordan Madden, who's helping organize at Georgia State University.
All of us are working. All of us are studying and wrapping up our semesters and getting finals. Some people are graduating in December. We had to move very swiftly and effectively.
Organizers say pop-up early vote locations on three Atlanta campuses surpassed November's early vote turnout there, and at least 16,000 voters under 30 who did not vote in November have voted in the runoff so far.
That's WABE's Sam Greenglass. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The FIFA World Cup continues in Qatar after a thrilling end to the group stage.
16 teams have been eliminated and 16 are still kicking.
The U.S. faces the powerhouse Dutch team in the knockout stage today.
NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman is in Doha covering the World Cup and he joins us now. Hi, Tom. Welcome.
Hi, Sarah.
Set the stage for us, Tom. A talented but very young U.S. team faces the Netherlands this morning. What should we expect?
Well, I'm going to predict a close, tense, exciting match. You know, I get paid for really concise predictions like that. The U.S. is the second youngest team in this World Cup, but it's played with great poise and played really good defense, holding three opponents in the group stage to a total of one goal. The Americans are still lacking go-to scorers. This has been a weakness. Although the good news on the scoring and playmaking front, forward Christian Pulisic has been cleared to play. He suffered a pelvic contusion as he scored that dramatic winning goal against Iran earlier this week.
So what should we know about the other team, about the Americans' opponents today?
The Netherlands are ranked eighth in the world, a country with a great soccer history, World Cup runners-up in 2010, third place in 2014. But despite that history, the team is young. It failed to qualify for the last World Cup, like the U.S., and there's talk that it's vulnerable because even though it won its group in the group stage here, it underperformed. Maybe. But the U.S. should not relax, and it certainly won't. The Netherlands haven't lost in their last 10 World Cup matches. A very talented team with their 23-year-old breakout star, Cody Gakpo. He's 6'4". That's really big in soccer.
It's big anywhere.
Yeah, really. He's big and fast, and he scored three goals in three matches. The Dutch also have one of the best defenders in the world, Virgil van Dijk. And talk about big, Sarah, or at least tall, goalkeeper Andreas Noppert is 6'8". That's a big wall to get over or around. So the Dutch are a good team, a reason why they're favored today.
So explain this to us. How does this next knockout stage work?
The best way to explain for an American audience, it's just like March Madness, win or go home. No more draws. If there is a tie at the end of regulation, games can go 30 minutes of extra time and even longer with penalty kicks to decide a winner. Now, U.S. coach Greg Berhalter calls it a second tournament, requiring different planning, different styles of play and strategy. There won't be as much conservative hanging back because you gotta win.
And half of the teams that started have already been eliminated. So that final elimination process is creating quite a week, it seems.
An absolutely exhilarating and heartbreaking last week, depending on who you're rooting for. Every team played its final group stage match, and practically every one of those matches had significance as far as determining who goes on and who's out. Teams were scrambling to score more goals to increase their goal differential, one of the possible criteria for deciding who advances. And so fans at games were checking their phones to see how other matches were going that might have an impact on the match in front of them. TVs were showing split-screen action, two games at once. Fans of Poland, Japan, South Korea loved that craziness because their teams prevailed. Fans of Mexico, Germany, and Uruguay, not so much. Their teams were eliminated.
Before we let you go, I want to talk about a historic moment that took place on Thursday in the match between Germany and Costa Rica, but not because of anything to do with the results, right?
Yeah, that's right. Stephanie Frappat of France became the first female referee in a men's World Cup game. And it was also the first ever all-female refereeing trio. Female assistant refs from Brazil and Mexico also were on the field. Now, it wasn't lost on people that this moment happened in Qatar, a conservative country where some women aren't allowed to live fully independent lives, with some male guardianship laws in place requiring a woman to get permission to work in certain fields or travel abroad if they're under the age of 25. So having the first female referee, a figure of power and authority in a men's World Cup match, that's meaningful, especially here.
NPR's Tom Goldman, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And that's Up First for Saturday, December 3rd, 2022. I'm Sarah McCammon.
And I'm Aisha Roscoe. Up First is back tomorrow with the story of an alleged war crime in Ukraine and what it says about the challenges of being a war crime investigator.
And we have more news and interviews, books and music every weekend on the radio.
Weekend edition, you know, check it out every Saturday, Sunday morning on your local NPR station. Find your station at stations.npr.org.